Welcome back to Filthy Hope for this bonus podcast, a longer, uncut version of my interview with Rachel Collis. There was so much great stuff that I thought was just too good to leave on the cutting room floor, so we hope you enjoy this bonus episode, and we'll see you again very soon on Friday. Rachel, how are you?
I'm very well.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks
do you want
for having me.
Introduce yourself to our listeners and who you are.
My name's Rachel Collis. I'm a 41-year-old mother of one. I've got a little 3.5-year-old girl. I'm an ex-teacher turned singer-songwriter person, bohemian artist. And I'm a United Church person. Have been for quite a while now. So, yeah, that kind of sums me up.
Yeah, awesome.
Tea drinker.
Are you a coffee or a tea person?
I'm definitely a tea person. I actually don't like the taste of coffee.
Okay.
I love the smell of coffee.
Yep.
But it's too bitter for my
My partner is a tea drinker, strictly.
Yes.
But she is also a trained barista.
Oh.
Which makes for very strange, like she hates the taste of coffee, but she'll make me an amazing coffee in the morning if she can be bothered.
Does she test taste?
No. So okay. I don't, part of it is like, she doesn't love the taste, but she knows all the technique about how to extract the right flavors and
fair enough.
The right, I don't even know. There's like different lengths of extraction or something.
Yes,
I don't know. You put it down in front of me and I'll drink it person. Like I'm not at all into all of that
stuff. You just want the caffeine.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
No, I'm definitely a tea only person.
Yeah. Oh, especially, and we're both performers and singers. Mm. Coffee. I actually find on the odd occasion that I have had coffee before performing, because I'll usually have coffee with milk in it, and the dairy going into the throat is not great for singing.
So. No, it isn't, but I find psychologically it can make me not like less nervous, in the sense that I'm kind of going, this is so fine. I've totally got this. It doesn't even matter if I have a milkshake beforehand. Mm. And so I have the milkshake as a way of saying, it's all fine. I've got this.
Yeah.
Rather than, I feel like if I'm trying to psych myself up with, you know, room temperature water with a squeeze of lemon or something, it's just going to make me more nervous.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes I just play the milk game. But I did one time before performing, they had like a supper spread at the venue ready.
Mm.
And I grabbed like a piece of, it was some crumbly, slicey, homemade slicey thing. And partway through the first verse, something must have got lodged, and I had the overwhelming need to cough.
Yeah.
And I couldn't. And I think I managed to get through the first verse to where there was a little break, did a little off to the side, and then managed to get through the song before I could have a good cough and a drink of water. But it does occasionally bite me in the, you know.
Yeah. I've had to sneeze on stage before as well. That's never
in
fun.
In mid-song?
Mid-song, because you can't, like when you need to sneeze, you just need to sneeze.
You need to sneeze, yeah.
It's happened once where I've just had to stop singing and sneeze.
And sneeze.
And you just laugh about it and keep going.
Yeah, It's got to happen.
It's got to happen. There's nothing you can do about it. So part of the reason we have you on, and not the only reason, because you're an amazing artist and I want to talk to a whole bunch of artists anyway, but you just released an album.
I did.
And off mic we were figuring out it was a week ago to the day.
A week ago, October 14, I released it's my fifth studio album, but officially my fourth, because the first one I did it as a student, so I've kind of hidden that one away.
Gotcha,
my fourth. And it's called Mayfly, and it's like a double disc, and it's probably the most ambitious, certainly the most expensive album I've ever created, but it's exciting. Like it's been this huge leap forward creatively. Like I always feel like, you know, everything I make is – I grow in between and everything sort of moves forward. But this time I just felt like I kind of leapt, you know, when you're kind of in your development, you suddenly leap forward and it feels that way. And now that I'm kind of putting it out there and have people listening to it, they're saying the same thing. So they're not saying, you know, oh, your other stuff was terrible and this is great. they're people who liked my previous stuff, but that are saying, this is really good. This is even better. So, so that's really exciting.
Yeah, and it's a double album.
It's a double.
17 tracks, is that right?
17 tracks, two discs.
Yeah.
I know, it was a bit insane.
As someone who struggles to put out one song on the best, like I think this year I've put out two total, like 17. We'll get into that because I'd love to hear more about the writing process and songwriting. Before we get into that as well, I wanted to we have a couple of connections through mutual friends. So we were chatting to Phil.
Yes.
Just beforehand, who is the minister here at, we're recording here at Tomorrow Uniting Church.
Yes.
You know Phil from
years ago.
Years ago, right?
Yeah. So I went, the first Uniting Church I went to was North Rocks Uniting when Phil was the minister there. Yes. So that was, I don't know, it might have been, it was the mid 2000s. Mm-hmm. And I went there for a long time, like almost a decade. And so, got to know Phil really well. He's a gamer and my husband's a gamer. So they spent, I think most of our married life has been spent with Phil on the other side of a microphone. saying, and so I would arrive home and, you know, say, hi, Steve, it's my husband. And he'd say, hi, Rachel. And then Phil would be like, hi, Rachel, I'm here too. And so there's, you know, he's been in my house a lot. Yeah. They're not gaming so much anymore, but they did for a long time there. It was intense and it was all the time.
Yeah, I remember because I worked with Phil for 3 years almost. And it was a shock to me the day that I discovered how into video games that he was. But it makes complete sense when you know that he comes from an IT background.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And I think, I think the only reason why my husband and he don't game as often anymore is because they've actually diverged in terms of the games they're playing. So there's less overlap anymore. So they kind of are like, you know, yeah, we'd like to game, but you're playing the wrong one at the moment. You know, what are we going to do? How are we going to solve this problem? So it's, you know, that's their world.
Go. I think the first time I met Phil was at Aurora, which I remember you performed at. I don't know if you remember this, but you actually performed using my keyboard.
Did I?
Yeah.
Hang on. I performed at...
This was the one at Stanwell Tops in 2017.
Did I?
Yeah.
Did I not use my own keyboard?
No, and I was there performing just my own stuff.
Yeah,
and
right.
And I was, still am, good mates with the person who was technical director of the festival.
Braden? Is that Braden? No.
Not Braden. Nick Golden.
Like
the tech side of, but yes, I'm also good mates with Braden.
Yeah.
And it might have actually been Braden, actually, now I think about it, said, Rachel Collis is performing and needs a keyboard. I don't remember what the circumstance was. And I was like, well, I've got one. She can just use that if she wants.
I don't even know why I wouldn't have had a keyboard. Or maybe I was just lazy and didn't want to bring it.
I mean, it was, I call it the coffin. It's currently standing up in its case in my office and it is so big, which I think is, because it's like a nice weighted keyboard.
Yes.
It's really important. But lugging that thing around all the way out to Stanwell Tops.
That's possibly why I said to Braden that I didn't want to bring my keyboard because I have the same problem. I find that I got asked recently to sing at like a short spot at a gig and it was sort of an unpaid one. And I'm like, oh, you know, I don't want to lug my keyboard. And then the guy was like, I'll help you. I'll come out to your car. I'll bring it in. I'm like, sold.
Yeah.
As long as I don't have to carry it, I'm fine.
Yeah. I have a memory of there were those little carts, like golf cart type things that you drive around the camp on.
Yep.
Holding on to the case, like the handle of the case, and dragging it along on its wheels behind the cart on the road because it was too big to fit in there. Yeah.
Yes.
Blows my mind that was what?
That was 27. Yeah. Was it 2017?
2017, yeah. So
wow.
That was January of 2017, so I'd just finished high school as well.
Oh wow.
I was on my
You're so young.
Yeah. What, 24 now, I think. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's how old I am too.
I will tell another story about Aurora. I was also there. My brother's band was playing. He's even younger. And one of their guitarists couldn't go, so I was playing guitar with them.
Cool.
And we were performing with Phil's son, Matt, his band, and their band, who at the time were called Long Story Short. We were performing outside as everyone was entering the festival.
Oh, cool.
Under this gazebo.
Yes.
The gazebo also then had like a riser for the band. So the gazebo was not like not very far away from the tops of everyone's heads. And we had rehearsed at this one point in one song, we're all going to do this big punk jump and it's going to look sick. And it looked amazing when we did it on main stage, but doing it under this gazebo. And I remember it was probably, I don't know, 15 centimeters above my head, and I've just jumped straight up, whacked my head on this metal pole. And I'm like, oh, keep playing, keep playing.
Were
and I'm
looking. Concussed?
I don't think so. Okay. I remember it, so that's good. But I'm looking around at the people that are watching going like, has anyone noticed? And everyone's watching Max, the lead singer. But I see my mate Fisher, shout out Fisher if you're listening, all the way at the back just pissing himself laughing. Yeah. So like the one person noticed it.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's always the way, I think. I had a friend have her petticoat fall off on stage at a really posh sort of classical concert. She was the accompanist. No one noticed. She even said she put it up in the air and did a twirl with it after performing and didn't even – was not a stir from the audience. But, you know.
Yeah. There you go. stuff like that just happens.
It does.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to talk to you about music, obviously, because we are both musicians.
Yes.
I am very curious, whenever I meet musicians, what was your childhood like in terms of music? So did you have like a musical family? When did you start learning an instrument?
I think my mum had always wanted to play piano because her mother was like an organist in the country and she'd go around and do millions of services on Sunday. And so she got piano lessons for me and my sister. So we started learning piano from a very young age. And because we were sort of young, we were then good for our age, which then kind of encouraged us to keep going. So we both went on these long journeys of classical training. But for me, what I really loved was I went to a Christian school that had, it was quite a strange school, but they had amazing chapel services with amazing singing. And so I loved that. And then when I was like 11, I got given Amy Grant, Heart in Motion for Christmas. And I think that was like my first like pop cassette. It was a cassette. And that opened this whole world up of, I started listening to the radio. I started, you know, I got Amy Grant's entire back catalogue. But I really sort of fell in love with songwriters. Like that was where it was at for me. And, you know, like I do my classical practice for, you know, I think I agree with my mum, I do an hour a day through high school. And, you know, I got paid 20 or 40 cents or something. I can't remember what it was. It was pretty minimal. But as soon as that was done, I'd get out like the Amy Grant songbooks and just loved playing contemporary music and loved that so much more than anything that I was learning in my classical training. And played in the band at church from the time I was about 12. So sort of, you know, got my chops playing with a rhythm section and, yeah, so I think that's where it really kind of started for me.
And just one sibling, sister?
Just one older sister,
Yeah. I love talking to other musicians who grew up in churches because I think we take for granted how much of a blessing playing every week with other people is.
Totally.
There are not many other spaces where you just get that freedom to play in groups the time.
I once had someone, this was years ago, try to sort of say something denigrating to me about my lack of band experience. And I don't think they realised that I had been, that I was a churchgoer. Yeah. I've been playing in bands, you know, for decades. Yeah.
And so actually I resonated with the, so like I'm also classically trained in piano.
Yeah, right.
And I remember getting, there was a My Chemical Romance piano transcription book and there was a Coldplay one and there was a The Fray one, I think.
You're so much younger than me.
I would have to, like I'd do my eighth grade, all the scales and the blah, 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 but then I'd get to, you know, play
my
game songs and stuff
totally,
like that.
Totally, yeah.
But yeah, and playing in, like I think I was 14 when I started playing in church.
Yeah.
And so that's, 10 years of most weeks playing with other people.
Totally.
Musicians. Totally. That's incredibly rare.
It is. And with people of different ability levels too in church. So you constantly, you just learn so much about adapting, about leading when you have to, about, you know, about sitting back when you need to, like it,
Yeah.
It's a huge advantage as a musician.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so moving on from there, what was the pathway for you to becoming, I mean, I love the phrase professional musician. What does that even mean?
I know. But it implies that we make money. Which is hilarious. Yeah.
But what was the pathway like from that, from being a younger musician going up through church and being classically trained into what you're doing now?
Well, there was a big gap. So I, for a whole bunch of reasons, like I dreamed of being a singer-songwriter. That was kind of the dream. And, you know, second best option was the songwriter. But mm-hmm. there was songwriter was in both. And then for a whole lot of reasons, I ended up going off and studying German teaching kind of completely abandoning music. I mean, I say abandoning music. I was still playing. I was still doing stuff. But abandoning it as a career possibility. And so I spent 6 years in the classroom. And then I started getting burnt out, which I think now that I look at it, it's not that I didn't love teaching. It's not that I wasn't good at teaching. It's that it just wasn't the right path for me. You know, when something's just not quite right, you burn out. Mm. You slowly get tired and it doesn't energize you the way that it does for someone for whom that's their first passion. And so I kind of left that. And then shortly after that, I went and studied music. And when I did a master's in composition, I actually started out doing piano performance. And just because I thought, oh, that's my strongest instrument, that's where I should go. And shortly after, you know, being there, it became very clear from all of the people around me, all of the people that were kind of mentoring me, that that I was a composer first. And so I started focusing on songwriting. And from there, I started writing again. I didn't think I'd be any good at it because I think in my head, I'd thought I've had all of these piano lessons and I'd had singing lessons too. And so there was a sense of I'm not going to be able to write because I haven't spent my 10,000 hours, you know, learning how to compose. How could I possibly be good at writing? And this really strange kind of eye-opening moment when I was studying is that I had to do this random composition. It was a film composition course. It was a combined coursework research master's. And I thought, oh, I have to do this course. It's the only one that fits. I didn't know how to use, I've got Logic now. I had no idea how to use any of that. I didn't even have a MacBook. I had to buy a MacBook. I thought, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to sync a composition to video. How does anybody do this? I don't know how to write. And then I blitzed the course. And I had so much fun doing it. And I think that I had a really cool conversation with the teacher afterwards where I said, this is really surprising me how well this is going and how much fun I'm having. And he said to me, well, do you like practicing your instrument? And I thought, well, not really. Like I saw people around me who would spend 8 hours a day, you know, alone with their instrument if they could. Every time they had a moment, they're like, I just want to play my instrument. And I'd never been like that with the piano. But I think that because my passion was for songs and, you know, I sort of came to the belief that when something is led by passion, we often make an unconscious study of it without realizing it. And so even though I hadn't officially studied composition, I unconsciously had been taking on board so many things about writing and about what kind of songs I like and what makes them work for a long time, so that when I started writing, suddenly it really fit. And I got, you know, sort of some overwhelming feedback at the beginning that made me feel like I was on the right path. And the first thing I did was a one-woman cabaret show, but it was just because I was writing. I was musical director for someone else's cabaret show at the time, and I was just writing this bizarre variety of songs. Some were comic, some were, you know, I love Tim Minchin and I was inspired by that, and this friend's cabaret show, there were some other comedians there, so I was inspired by that, plus writing, you know, serious singer-songwriter stuff. It was just all over the shop. And I just thought when I was rehearsing for her show, I just thought, well, why couldn't I do this? Mm. And so I did. And then from then I thought, but what I really want to do is be a recording artist, you know, a real McCoy singer-songwriter. And so I kind of went from I went from that performance into the studio and started sort of focusing on being the singer-songwriter.
Mm.
Yeah.
Awesome. And 17 songs across a record.
Yeah.
How long, forgive me, I've forgotten, how long between projects has this been?
So my last one was released in April 2019. So okay. It was, and then I had a baby in May 2019. Yeah, so it's a couple of years worth of writing.
Yeah. So, and I was having this conversation with, it was actually my brother. We write songs together. Just breaking down like the process of whether a hook comes first or a rhythm section comes first or a lyric comes first or if it all comes together at one time. Can you speak to a little bit about, let's say, put yourself back in, I don't know, when you started writing for Mayfly, but what, how does a song start for you?
Well, it varies. I think I'm a more confident lyricist than music writer. And I think that's because when I started, I assumed that I would be a better music writer because of my musical background. And so I worked really, really hard on the lyrics. And so I think that I have, because of that, I have a much more conscious awareness of how to make a lyric work,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to music where I've used more intuition. So it feels a little bit more hit and miss. But I think I started always, the two would kind of come together, a hook, a lyrical hook with kind of a melody or a vague melodic or groove kind of shape to it. And then it would expand from there. And then as I got more confident lyric writing, I ended up all the time just writing these lyrics and then going and putting music to them. But I've found over time that I started getting stuck in similar patterns. So now I try very deliberately to break the pattern. So I'll write a song with no lyrics and just something that feels good, the phrases will work, and then I'll sit down and try to write words that fit, which is hard. But I find that doing it that way, I seem to write better lyrics. Having that structure kind of helps. Sometimes I'll try to start with like a groove or a musical hook. I think any approach works. And I think I just try to not always do it the same way anymore because I find that I can get stuck or I just, you know, sit down at the piano and the same kind of stuff comes out. And if I'm writing lyrics always first, they often have a similar shape to the phrases. So going the other way around forces me to just have a different pattern about the way I write. So I like, you know,
changing it up.
And
in that process, are you handwriting music or are you recording to like a voice memo thing? Or
I'm a handwriter.
Yeah,
I've got a journal for lyrics. I've got manuscript paper.
Mm-hmm.
I do use my phone, particularly if I'm on the go to record things because I have learnt that, I don't know, I think part of my process as well is going when the muse strikes, get it down and then to look at it when I officially sit down to do some work on songs, I can then look at the things that were developed when the muse came and visited me.
Yeah.
So I do record things, but I do tend to – I then get them on paper.
Yeah.
It's all very old school. Like I have Sibelius and I have notation software and an audio software, but I don't use it for writing.
For writing.
Maybe I should. I know some people will, you know, develop like a groove or a loop in Logic and then try to write around that. So that might be something for me to try.
It's so interesting because I also write fiction and I'm always a handwrite. Always, always, always.
Yeah.
Because there's the tactility of it
is
really important to me. But then when it comes to songwriting, for whatever reason, I think because I grew up with a MacBook with GarageBand on it, the way that I wrote music was I would plug my guitar into GarageBand and record
and start
stuff.
That way. Yeah.
Which is interesting because then that works really well for something like if you're in, so I mean like a punk and hardcore band, which is very like riff centric.
Yes.
And that's very easy to write in that way, especially if you don't need to necessarily come up with melodies because the vocals are screamed anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's
it's a more math. It's almost more and more like mathematical thing of piecing pieces in place. Whereas if I'm writing for another project or if I'm arranging someone else's project or if I'm doing church music, I actually find that writing things down and doing it almost actually live with other people in yes. the writing process often is way more, I mean, you spoke about the muse. I think that often, if the muse does exist, yes. comes to speak yes. to me in that setting with other yeah. people present as well.
Yeah.
Which brings me to, because there are a bunch of people that you collaborated with yes. on Mayfly.
Yeah.
What was that like? Because so, you tend to write by yourself first, or did you bring these other people into, and maybe who are they? And
so there's a few people I collaborate with. The main collaborator is a woman called Peter Muir, and we studied together. And, you know, I remember the first time I heard one of her songs, I was at Central Station on the way home, and, you know, I think she'd emailed it to me and I was listening to it. And, you know, it was one of those songs where I just needed to sit down and stop and listen. And I thought, okay, this is someone who writes the kind of music that I love or the kind of song that I love. And so I think it was probably a couple of years after that I got stuck on something and I thought, we'd talked about doing it together for ages, but, you know, needs must. I got stuck and I said, okay. And so in the early days, we both kind of work in isolation from each other. So I would email her what I'd done and she'd rewrite it and email it back, and then I'd rewrite it and email it back, and it would go back and forth until both of us said, okay, we're happy. Now we've done so much writing together that we kind of know exactly what, like, it became very clear what our strengths and weaknesses were as a pair. And so now I take her on a weekend away.
Oh,
we
really?
Go, yeah, that's we awesome. Go for the weekend away, but we still write in isolation. And I hand her a pile of stuff and I say, okay, this needs a chorus melody, or this, you know, I quite like this, but it's just not quite working. Or, and she goes away and she works on that, and she usually gives me some stuff and I take that away and work on that. And then we, And now I feel much more like it's just really easy now. So usually she'll give me stuff, I'll make a few tweaks, and then I don't even really feel the need to send it back to her. Like, I've got a sense of, oh, yeah, I know what – we kind of know how we work. And then there was another collaborator for the first time, a guy called Ken Lai, who I met back in 2015. I did, like, a vocal session for him. And he said he'd really like me to write some lyrics for him. So he gave me two pieces of music back in 2015. And I wrote lyrics to one and he was really happy with them. And that was like probably the first time that I had like a restrictive melody, because he's like a music theatre guy.
Right.
So I'm not allowed to muck with the phrasing.
Yep.
Like, you know, I can add, if I'm lucky, I can add a little quaver in there and there, but, you know, it's got
to
be...
to
as
the grid.
Is.
Yep.
And then the second song, he really didn't like what I did with it, and I did like five rewrites before he was happy with what I'd done. And then and I ended up doing those two songs on the second disc. But even then, you know, I kind of decided earlier, I kind of said to him, look, I want to do this second disc that's kind of just a piano and vocal kind of thing, and I think these songs would really fit. But we have to find a lyric for this second one that you're happy with. And so we end up doing that. And then there's another song on the first disc with full production that I said, look, why don't you write some music that you think sounds like me, and I'll write a lyric to it. And so that was an interesting experiment.
Which
too.
One was that?
Beside My Ordinariness. And then he orchestrated, because he's an orchestrator, so he orchestrated on two of the tracks, another one called Siren, which I wrote. He orchestrated for full orchestra. And then this was the first time I'd ever done anything like this. He gave me the MIDI, so it's an East-West, so it's quite a good sample library. And then I took that to my producer, and then he has this trick, because he does a lot of studio music, where he would record just the strings. We recorded the horns, because there were some trombone parts. We recorded them separately because they're just single line. But with the strings, he'd get them to play twice close to the mic, once about a meter back, and then he puts that sound behind the MIDI and it kind of sounds real.
Yeah.
So it was quite but if you sort of got the mix wrong, it didn't. So it was quite it was a big sort of learning curve. But so, yeah, there's two songs on the the first disc with full orchestrations, which I've never done before, but it was fun.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. And so when you come, you've got a song.
Yep.
And it's time to go to the studio.
Yep.
How much of that is locked in and how much of that for you? Because I've had sort of both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Where the studio has been quick and easy. The songs are all done and yes. maybe there's a harmony we decide to throw in, but yep. that's it. And it's just you get in, you track it, you dot all the I's, cross all the T's, done. But I've also had where you're in there and suddenly you go, we've opened the song up and there's all these things that we need to tweak yes. or change or yeah. fix or rewrite. Or,
which so, is expensive
yes,
because
yes.
it's time. You have exactly. to pay for the time. So I try, the first time I ever recorded the infamous album that disappeared from platforms, I arranged everything. I wrote like drum charts. I didn't really know anyone that was going to play on the album. I didn't have a band. So I was just like, I'm going to have to provide all these musos with charts. And it wasn't that I was like writing out all the drum fills or anything, but you know, I'd give him like a bar of groove and I felt like I had to decide on the groove. And so I did that for everyone. And I'd never recorded before and I did like 8 takes of the piano parts because, you know, it was slightly uneven and I was worried that I was going to ruin the project because it was slightly uneven, you know, and there were so many things that I just didn't know. But I felt like the overall impact was it didn't have, I don't know, I just came to sort of go, a drummer or a bass player can come up with something so much more nuanced and better than what I could come up with when I don't play that instrument. Mm. And so now I take like a big umbrella approach, but at the same time I don't want to faff around in the studio because it's so expensive.
Yeah.
So what I do is I write these charts. I start with bass and drums and I write these charts for them that are basically just empty bars with slash marks.
Yeah,
and yeah. It might have like some structure in it, like don't play for this verse, or if there's some, you know, stabs that I want us to all do together, I'll mark them. And then we get together before we go in the studio and, you know, I often listen to tracks and go, I like that kind of feel, I like that kind of feel, and we jam it out together. And then I take the rhythm section in and then Sean, who's a producer, he either likes it or he'll say if it's not working as well and he'll have stuff to say as well. And they're both really experienced session players, so they're very used to working that way and having to sort of change things on the fly. And yeah. so that's really quite efficient. And then piano-wise, because I have a vision, I write it all out. So I to stop myself from overplaying, because I want to leave lots of space for the guitars, I write it mm-hmm. and then I play it. So that's always really efficient. And then Sean does all the guitar work on top of that, unless it's a song that I don't want much piano on. And then all the other elements come in. And everything else is spontaneous, so synthesizers, other percussion elements. That all
I was
going to
say, there's some interesting percussion going on.
There are.
As
we
well.
Did some
yeah.
cool stuff yeah, this yeah. time. That was all Sean. I think he's building his toolkit and
yeah.
So we had a day with the drummer. He'd come back in and do percussion, and we got out all these wood blocks. And,
yeah.
He did some interesting ostinatos, and we put some interesting delays on the. Yeah. So, yeah. So a lot of that kind of. Once it's kind of the body of it is in there, Sean as the producer is very good at going, what is it sonically missing? Like what
can we add to make it?
What can we add? Yeah, like is it too bottom-endy? Do we need to, you know, add some sparkle up top, or do we need, you know, like he's very good at hearing what's missing from the mix and so we work that out spontaneously. So it's kind of a mix because, I'm always trying to work as fast as I possibly can. But I don't want to suck the life out of it. And I feel like when people are playing to a chart and it's really prescribed, they don't play with the same, it just doesn't, I don't know, it just doesn't feel as organic. And so, so I try not to over prescribe because I want it to feel, and it's hard to make a record where you can correct everything. Like
yeah.
you can fix everything, but if
get
you
it to
do,
feel human and alive
yeah.
and yeah.
Yeah,
it's
and you've
got
to work out where that line is between.
You want it to sound professional, but you don't want it to yes. sound squeaky clean and.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, it's got to have the human element in there somewhere, but you don't want it to sound sloppy. So that's always the.
Yeah.
Yeah, the challenge.
There's a, I don't know if you saw that Beatles documentary recently.
I did. However many hours of it. Yeah.
There's a moment where one of them plays Hey Jude for the first time.
Yep.
And there's no vocal microphone. There's nothing on the – there's like a room mic and that's it.
Yeah.
And the caption comes up, this is the first time Hey Jude was played or whatever. And you compare – it's like the song's there.
Yeah.
The song is all there. But compared to the recorded version.
Yeah.
I actually think that there's something in that version that you hear on the documentary.
Yeah.
That is so emotionally resonant.
Yes.
That kind of gets lost. It's still there because the bones of the song are still there. And so I always think about that when thinking about how a producer in a studio plays into the song and how to preserve what is exciting and resonant about the song without completely producing the hell out of it.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's I years ago, because I think I did that first project and then the second time I was like, oh, I don't care. I'm relaxed about everything. You know, well, this was Nightlight, the record was called. And Sean said to me one time, he said, oh, there's something creaking in the piano. I think we're just going to have to redo that and I'll just go and fix it. I'm like, leave it in there. I don't care. So in one of the songs that you can hear this kind of rattle in the piano. Uh-huh. And I'm just, to me now, that's like part of the charm.
Yeah.
But there was a song I did on that one where I said to Sean, I just want to sing it at the piano. And he was like, you know, beads of sweat dripping because he knew he wouldn't be able to touch anything because he wouldn't be able to edit. He could do major edits, but he couldn't separate the piano vocal, you know, couldn't tune the vocal. And so it's just a take of me singing live in the studio. And I remember when I played it for my husband the first time, he didn't recognize that it was like, I thought it was like really obvious that like it's not a vocal comp, there's no tuning, there's no, he didn't pick up any of that. He was just like, I feel like that's the most, of all the songs on the record, I find that one the most moving. And I thought, that's really interesting because I'm listening to it going, that note's a bit flat, you know, but we couldn't change it. And, you know, I'm hearing all of that. But he didn't hear any of that. He just hears this more emotional performance. And I think that's been a big lesson for me. And not to be overly precious too about myself and my playing and my singing and, or anybody else's for that matter. Like if they're a good musician, you know.
It'll shine through the production of it.
Totally.
Yeah. There's this thing called Nail the Mix where you sign it. It's like a subscription based thing and each month you get the stems to a song that's already been released. Cool. And then it's like a monthly competition for like you submit your mix and you can win prizes.
Wow.
But it's so interesting to go into the sessions with the raw stems with no plugins, nothing.
Yep.
And hit like you'll get DI tracks for guitars opposed to amp sounds.
Yeah.
And you go through these songs that you have heard growing up or whether they're new or whatever and you just have this thing in your brain of, well, that's this perfect professional production of a song. But you go through the sessions half the time, like the guitars aren't perfectly lined up.
Yep.
There's vocal thing. Like if you've got two people singing harmonies into the one microphone and they're slightly out of tune, all of a sudden, like
It's in
tune for the mix and the rest of the song is in tune with the out of tune harmony. Like there's all these different things where once you sort of like, and there's been a lesson for me as well, is you hear like, I'm going to throw Blink-182 under the bus here. they're one of their most recent albums. It just sounds like an algorithm made it because the guitars are so in tune. The vocal is so tuned. Everything is to the grid. Travis Barker's a demon of a drummer, but it sounds like MIDI drums. I don't know what it is.
Yeah,
and that was a real lesson for when you go into the studio, you got to preserve some of that human element of the play.
You do. And I think as well, I think it was Sean that told me this, that when we're listening to particularly a drummer playing, what keeps our attention is when it goes off the grid.
Yeah.
So if it's on the grid, we fall asleep. It's those little micro, and obviously you don't want it to be out of time.
No.
You know, if a fill is rushed, I'm going to move it. If it's, you know, if it doesn't line up with the bass, I'm going to move them but we move them closer together.
Yep.
Not exactly together, but just closer. Because I think that's what on an unconscious level, that's what keeps you interested.
Yeah.
And I think it's even the same with using auto-tune. I have no shame about using auto-tune. I think a lot of people don't realize that everything
literally everything is
auto-tuned. But you don't have to turn it up really high all the time.
No.
And you can choose when to use it and when not to use it. And it's in that making those judgment calls that you are able to both polish and make it sound professional, but also maintain a lot of the integrity and the life. Like it's yeah, and you hear it in really polished pop records where they've just auto-tuned the crap out of it, and you know, this is terrible. My brain's going straight to the greatest. What's it called? The greatest showman. Particularly when the kids singing, because kids just don't sing in tune, and there's this little boy singing, and it's just too. It's so clearly being tuned because it just doesn't match the kind of quality that you would get from a boy's voice. Yeah. And so I still love the album. I still listen to it all the time. But, you know, but that's not, obviously not the kind of sound that I'm trying to aim for. And it is, it's such a balance. Like I feel like I'm always learning. And that's why I like working with other people too, because, you know, it, you know, I like working with people that are super experienced and that I can just, you know, by osmosis gain their talent from them.
Yeah, and you're almost like the responsibility and the pressure, you just hand it off to that other person.
Totally. And it also allows me to be creative too, because I can go, wouldn't it be amazing if we did this, and know that there's someone sitting there in the studio who will either say, that's a great idea, let's do it. And if they do, I know it's a good idea. Mm. And if they say, I don't know, Rach, then I know, okay, it's not a good idea. Yeah. So it's that's why I love collaboration so much. Mm. Yeah. Mm. It's always a team effort. I get the name on the front of the record. It's always a team effort.
That's awesome. I wanted to talk to you as well about the release. Mm. So you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's just on your website. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So talk to me about that.
All exclusive. Yeah. So basically when I started out, I had this naive belief that if I poured lots of money at it, you know, top producer, lots of publicists, that it would magically mean that there would be it would have some kind of impact. And I learnt the incredibly hard way that it's very possible. And I think in most cases for an indie artist, you put a release out there, you sell 20 or 30 copies to the people you know, and that's it. That's the end of it. And so for all of the talk of, you know, back the time it was all about publicists and radio promo. It still is to a certain degree. Mm. But, you know, oh, if you put it out there on as many community radio stations as you can and you perform it, you know, in the corner of as many empty venues as you can, that somehow magically it's just going to take off. And it doesn't. It doesn't happen, you know. Like I went to Adelaide and did show after show after show to like two or three people in the room and just learnt that people don't come and hear an artist they've never heard of perform songs they've never heard of. It just doesn't happen. And so I think it just turned me into this realist. And this was, I was very poor by this stage because I spent a lot of money on publicists learning that, you know, it doesn't work. So I ended up discovering a completely different way of marketing music and primarily started growing my fan base through Facebook ads and growing a mailing list and then learning how to sell to that mailing list. And I discovered that people that love your music and that feel like a real fan and they've got a relationship with you, if you say to them, I'm only releasing on vinyl, they'll buy vinyl even if they don't have a record player. And so because I've learned how to sell, I've worked out that I say make more money, but I'm actually just trying to recoup expenses. Like I'm just trying to pay for the project, but I get more money back if I sell through my own site because I have control over what the prices are. You know, this is all business talk. It sounds all very money, 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 but I have a control over how much I sell it for. I don't have to pay anyone any fees. And I think in terms of, because it's all about Spotify now and so many people are only using Spotify. And so many people don't even have a digital playlist anymore. So trying to sell them a digital copy, I feel a little bit crazy going, I'm not on Spotify. I've got like four songs up there, I think, but that's it. Because I know that I'm excluding a certain listenership. But at the same time, I feel like there's three groups of people. Like there's the people that they're going to buy anyway. They're the CD digital playlist people. And then there's the Spotify only people, and then there's all these people in the middle that if it's on Spotify, they're going to listen there, but if it's not, they're going to buy. And I feel like it's kind of nerve-wracking to do something that's so countercultural. Mm. But it works for me because I think I've sold more copies of Mayfly than any other album so far.
Awesome.
And you know, I haven't surveyed my list. I could say to them, look, you know, if you didn't buy, tell me the reasons why you didn't buy, and I could find out that information. But I think that I don't know, I just have always been skeptical about the approach of doing things the way everybody else is doing them because everybody else is doing them that way. And yeah. I think if it doesn't work, and I mean, if you think about it, putting up your music for free, it's buying a lottery ticket, and it's a lottery ticket that you can't win because yep. as an indie artist, you don't have access to editorial playlists. So now, you know, my Facebook feed is filled with, I'm rambling here about Spotify now, but my Facebook feed is filled with playlist promoters,
yes.
advertising.
I'm the I don't same. Know whether you yeah, get yeah, that. Yeah. I get them all
and
the time.
And so they will happily take $5,000 of your dollars
yep.
to get your song on playlists that are probably riddled with bots.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the best case scenario? 20,000 to 100,000 streams, which is what, like,
it's barely 50 anything.
$50 if barely I'm lucky. Anything.
Yeah.
And they're not even real people. So any kind of argument of, oh, you know, like, they're going to come to your shows, or they're going to buy your merch, or they're like, they're not high quality listeners if they're real people. The ones that are real people, they're not people that have come to a show in the past or bought something from you or emailed you directly. And so, I don't know, I just look at it and go, I can't win that game.
Yeah.
And so I don't think I have to play it. And it may change. If I get mm-hmm. if I get to a stage in my career where I'm not selling any albums because nobody's buying anymore, I'll change my, you know, my strategy. But at this stage, there's a lot of people out there still buying music, and a lot of people buying CDs.
Yeah, more than ever. And vinyl as well.
And which, vinyl. Yeah. I mean, I buy vinyl. I don't even have a record player. I frame them and I put them on the wall. But people buying CDs and and they listen to it digitally, but they want the signed
physical copy. Yeah.
Physical copy. And so I just think that I think for any indie artist, I think learning how to sell is and then focusing on that is, you know, from a realistic perspective. And look, it doesn't preclude me from becoming a major rock star if I ever, you know,
if
the stars ever align. Yeah. Like, it's not going to stop that from happening. You know, some people would say, oh, you're not on Spotify, you're not visible to the record labels that are looking. And I'm kind of like, there may be some truth in that, you know, if you want to get major label attention, you need to be clocking up the millions of streams on Spotify. But I think I've been rejected by labels in the past.
Hmm.
You know, I think I've kind of gone. I had someone say to me once from a label, if you can sell 15,000 copies when you release an album, then we'd definitely be interested.
Wow.
And I thought, you know what? If I can sell 15,000 copies when I release an album, I don't want you.
Yeah.
I don't want, like,
yeah.
that's my living paid for a couple of years. Like, that's, yeah. So I think I'm just, and I don't want to sound jaded. Like, I'm genuinely not jaded. Mm. I'm genuinely enthusiastic about having discovered a way of doing things that doesn't leave me in a position of inevitable failure.
Mm.
And, you know, and so I do feel like, you know, shouting to the world and to every indie artist out there, hey, look at these marketing methods, or look at these, because these can work. Mm. But it's a hard sell saying to people, you know, if you want to sell, you might have to remove yourself from the grid and do it underground.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah. I've struggled with this the last couple of years because I don't remember what the exact figure is, but to make minimum wage.
Yes.
With just off Spotify streams is something like 7 or 8 million streams a month.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's as a solo artist,
yes.
Let alone if you have a band
yep.
or an agent or all yep. those different things that
take, or a record label.
Or a record label, taking whatever cut that they ask for.
I worked it out too and worked out that to pay for my album, not to make a profit, but to pay, I'd have to get 4 million streams.
Yeah.
or sell like 750 copies. It's like, to me, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
But it does take courage. And I do have moments when people will say, oh, are you on Spotify? You know, and I say, I'm sorry, I'm not. And I say, but if you like, you can buy a copy. And they and then they end up not buying. And I think I just have to keep reminding myself, I haven't lost anything because they were never going to buy anyway.
Yeah.
They were just going to go home and stream. And if someone wants to discover my music, there's songs up there. There's songs on YouTube. You know, it's not like they can't have
it's not
a
like
listen.
You're invisible.
And yeah, that's right. And see what the stuff is actually like. So
yeah.
So I mean, it might change. The landscape will continue to change, but that's kind of where I've ended up at the moment.
I was literally like the weekend 5 days ago when we were recording, I was at a party and I met someone for the first time and they asked, what do you do? And they were like, and I mentioned music. Like, oh, are you on Spotify? Can I check you out? And being able to say, yeah, here's the artist, go check it out. You know, and I saw the 5 or 6 extra streams that came through.
That's right.
So there is that benefit of like the immediacy.
That would have got you like 0.
Yeah, or nothing.
0.16 cents.
Nothing. Yeah. So the benefit is that they have immediate access, but that immediacy actually is the thing that is ruining, I think, fans engaging with artists in a really meaningful way.
Yeah.
Like when I buy, I'm a big vinyl guy.
Yeah.
When I buy a record, because when you have Spotify, you can skip through songs, you can stop whenever you want. The physical act of putting on a record, and I'm just talking about it's the same for CDs or if you have to go and buy it on digital or whatever, the commitment that it requires to obviously part ways with your money but also have a physical thing that you have to interact with to listen to has such a deeper level of engagement with the listener that it automatically just brings them into this extra category of fandom, if that's what you want
to
call it, where
you're
already bought in. You're already bought in.
That's right.
And
you know, it's kind of business 101 too, that I know some other people that are in other businesses that when they advertise on Facebook and they're choosing which audience they want to and they're narrowing their audience, one of the categories they choose is people that have already bought online from a similar company because that's just business, that if we want the likelihood of someone buying from you, the most likely person to buy an album from me is somebody who's bought an album from me before.
Yep.
Or someone who's bought an album from someone else who's similar before. So it's kind of, you're right. It's about investment and it's about their emotional investment in the music and But it's, you know.
Yeah. I try not to get too mad about it because at the same time I have music on Spotify, so I'm part of the issue at the same time.
No, you're not the issue.
But the issue is
Spotify.
Well, that's the guy that makes money off everyone else's music.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, but like how do you remove yourself from, and I think that's why I've been really curious to talk to you about it, is like how to remove yourself from that. It's almost a cultural thing these days where music is immediately available.
Yeah.
At no extra cost. It's just a subscription fee.
I think my only sort of answer to that is that failure. Yeah. As in, I mean, back when I was doing the album Nightlight in 2014 and I had, you know, I paid all that money on publicists and had all that record company rejection, that was kind of pre-Spotify. I mean, I think streaming existed, but it wasn't.
It's just around the corner, I think. It's like 2015, I think.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But I think because it was funny because even at the time I felt like radio promo wouldn't work and yet I did it anyway and paid the money for it because that was what everybody was telling me that I should be doing. And I think it's really only once you do it and then you realise as an artist that, you know, trying to persuade someone who is creating their first single ever to not put it up on Spotify where all their friends can listen to it. I mean, it's so hard to do, but I think – I don't know. I think I've been around long enough to kind of go, you know, I've tried the stuff that I'm supposed to try and it hasn't worked, and so I'm doing things differently and that is working, and so, you know,
just
continue down that path.
That's so cool. Yeah. We will wrap up in a sec because we've been going for quite a while, which is great. We've had such a great conversation. This is a church podcast, so yes, I feel obliged.
We should talk a little bit about faith.
Yeah. So I mean, how do you feel about I've been labeled. I find it really difficult when people in the past have labeled me a quote unquote Christian artist because that comes with a lot of
baggage
and connotations. How do you feel about where music and faith and performance and creativity and all those things swirling around? How do you tie those things down together?
Oh, really hard. I feel like I don't think I get labeled as a Christian artist, so I don't think I've had that issue so much, although some of my songs are about faith, but only some of them because I feel like I write about all of life. So I think part of the advantage of existing outside of, you know, in the underground, if you like, is that it does give me the freedom to go, it doesn't really matter if I do a faith-based song here and it's like the only one on the album. I think there are two on Mayfly that are explicitly faith-based because, you know, I don't have to fit into a particular category for promo or, you know. But I think creativity is part of our who we are as human beings. And so I think it's a really important physical expression of who we are. And so I think in many ways my creativity is my so much part of my spiritual practice. And a lot of my songs do come from my own faith journey. So I do like going to churches sometimes and talking about where the songs really came from. Whereas, you know, when I'm talking to my wider audience, which isn't much in person nowadays, it's mostly live streaming, I don't necessarily explain in the same way where a particular song might have come from because, you know, I don't sort of have an agenda to convert anybody or, you know, I want to talk about things in a way that feels inclusive to everybody. Like I feel like I definitely don't consider myself a Christian artist in the sense of the category of Christian music. I don't listen to a lot of Christian music, and so I listen to some, but not a lot. And so I just kind of, I don't know, I think of myself a little bit more like, you know, some of those sort of vintage 70s songwriters that, and even sometimes country artists, and they talk about faith just as part of talking about the whole landscape of life. And it's not that they're writing a song that is like either a worship song or a, you know, your typical kind of CCM song. They're just writing a song about life. And in one verse, they're talking about women and whiskey. And in the next verse, they're talking about praying down on their knees. And you know, and I like that because I feel like it's just, faith is just part of the landscape of life. And so, and I love the way that people who are not, do not consider themselves people of faith, write about their faith. Because, or I shouldn't say people of faith, people that don't consider themselves under the category of Christian and the way that they write about their faith, I like it because it feels so authentic, the language that they use, because they're not understanding faith in a way that a church is taught a person to understand faith. And so, you know, you go to church and people tell you, well, this is the Bible and this is what it means and this is how you understand it and this is the language we use to describe it. And then, you know, in Christian music a lot, people use that language to continue talking about faith. Whereas when someone who has no church background approaches, you know, writes a song about Jesus, they don't use any of that language. And so I feel like their response to Jesus, I love that. It just feels so authentic. And it's often blasphemous. It's sometimes it's sacrilegious, but it's real. And so I think that that's the kind of writing I aspire to, where the faith is truly integrated into life. And I think that that involves kind of removing the lenses of the church lenses that we put around theology and just coming to the experience of faith and being completely honest about whatever aspect of life or faith that is, even if it means saying something that's theologically incorrect or blasphemous or, you know, like I think I, in terms of my future writing about faith, I think I definitely want to try to pull that thread a little bit further and try to, because I do, I'm sort of unashamedly progressive, and I find that there's not a lot of Christian music that is progressive. And so I find when I'm listening to Christian music or looking at worship music, I don't often see my own faith reflected back at me. There are some. There is some progressive Christian music, but there's not a lot. And so I feel like I'm not trying to be a Christian artist, and I don't think I would ever just write exclusively about faith. But when I do write songs about faith, I'm trying to, I guess, talk about what my faith looks like. which is more progressive, but also to do it in an authentic way. I don't want to just take progressive language and shove it all over the way I describe faith. So it's, I guess that's kind of part of a new journey for me to see. You know, there have been songs explicitly about faith in the last couple of albums, but it's only a few. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of songs that I write that feel spiritual, about stillness or about appreciating the present moment or about shame or about, and that don't reference faith explicitly, and that I hope that a lot of people will find resonance with them, not just people that consider themselves people of faith. Yeah. Mm. I don't know whether that's answered your question at all.
Absolutely. There are a couple of things that really resonated with me, because I think part of why I don't get a lot out of a lot of Christian music, and why I know other people certainly don't, is because it's this almost like one size fits all how faith is expressed thing, which I not to say that it never happens. I do every so often, like every time, let's say, for example, Hillsong Uniting, every time they put out a record, I'll listen to it because I'm curious to see what's going on in the culture of mainstream Christian culture, all that stuff. But there's this, and I think part of what the whole point of this show is, and the name Filthy Hope, is that it is, I am more interested in faith and where that is a part of real life and not separated from real life, and the earthiness and the all the stuff that goes on in everyone's lives, whether or not we're going to admit it. For me, faith is expressed most resonantly and most helpfully for other people, but also for a whole bunch of different reasons, when it is a part of your whole life. It's not just this thing like the Sunday Christian expression of faith, where you go and do your thing during the week and then on a Sunday morning you come in and you go to worship. Then you go home and you forget about it. Like, I have no interest in that. I'd rather just not go to church if that's all it's going to be.
And I think we have another version of it too, where, you know, because I grew up in very sort of conservative Christian circles, and they definitely had that, you know, don't be a Sunday Christian, you know. But faith was still compartmentalized, but it was just a compartment that we took with us everywhere we went.
Right.
So it still was boxed up. It still was kind of separate from your authentic expression of who you are. And I remember at one stage reacting to, this is when I was in my early 20s, reacting to what felt like, you know, saying to someone, no one ever talks about, you know, their brokenness or their struggles. And having someone saying, what are you talking about? You know, so-and-so's got this going on and so-and-so's got this going on. And I remember thinking, but I didn't know that, because we never talk about, you know, what's really going on, in the same way as we never talk about what's really going on with our faith, and going, I don't know about that. I don't know if I believe that, or, gosh, I find it really offensive when Paul says that, or, you know, or, you know, virgin birth, I'm not sure about that. You know, like, and to be able to do that, and in a space that is authentic and safe, rather than having, you know, people say, okay, this is what Christians believe. Yeah. And then feeling like you have to fit into that. I think that we do it unconsciously as a church every time we do a course on how to read the Bible.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's just someone telling you how to read the Bible the way they read the Bible. And they were taught to read the Bible a certain way by, you know, the people that taught them. And it, I think it can remove the authenticity out of faith. And so even though we might be being a Christian all week, our faith has been separated, I think, from our authenticity, and we're kind of start to ignore our true reactions and our true emotions and our true responses to the text and to God. And yeah.
There's almost this fear that people have that if they ask that question or if they express that opinion or they, you know, say something that might be not quite theologically in line with what everyone says you're supposed to think, that it's almost this subconscious thing. Well, if I ask that question, will the whole thing vanish in a puff of smoke? Have I somehow accidentally just...
Will I pull a thread too far and then the whole thing, jumper comes out?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And as people of faith, at the very heart of it is this understanding that that is not going to happen because there is a God who is in totality true and
And if that jumper comes apart, maybe... And I describe myself as someone for who the jumper... For whom the jumper did. Sorry, I just corrected my own grammar. That was very nerdy. For whom the jumper did come completely apart.
Yeah.
But that allowed me to then reshape a very different looking faith. Mm. But it's a scary journey. It's a very scary journey. You know, and it starts with, for me, it started as a young woman going, I don't know that it's wrong to be gay because that's what I was taught. And then, you know, and then there's the next thread and then there's the next thread and suddenly... When your faith is so clearly defined as it must look like this and you pull at those threads, when your faith starts to look like something else, I think a lot of people don't recognize that as faith.
Mm.
And they go, oh, well, I must be an atheist now. I better stop going to church. And they don't realize that underneath that, which was maybe more, it's not even, I don't know, I don't even know whether that's faith. That's kind of, it's like a security of belief, security blanket of belief. Whereas faith is filled with uncertainty and that's what makes it faith.
Yeah.
And so when you're going there, I don't know about that. Or I don't know about that. And, you know, when you feel like, well, I think I believe in that 51%, you know, I tip the scales.
Yeah.
That's when it becomes, I think that's the far more exciting journey of faith because it really does feel like leaping off a ledge then as opposed to it doesn't feel like leaping off a ledge when you are absolutely 100% certain that everything you believe and have been told is true because there's no doubt there. So where's the faith?
There's no commitment to that either.
No.
You can just rest back in your certainness.
Totally. And like, totally.
Your certainty. And like, yeah, we've talked a little bit about on this podcast before unwillingness that a lot of people have to allow mystery to remain a mystery.
Yes.
But for me, that's like some of the most exciting things about faith is there are things that we don't know and we don't understand.
Yeah.
And in all likelihood, I'll die and I still won't totally understand.
Totally.
It's like I bristle whenever someone says anything to the effect of them having any certainty of what's going to happen after we die.
Yes.
I'm like, oh, have you been there?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It's this mystery, and there's scripture, and there's all these different things that we can look to try to wrestle with it.
Yeah,
whether it's prayer, whatever. But at the end of the day, that's what faith is. We don't actually know.
We don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, scripture's such a messy mix of different authors with different cultures and backgrounds,
different
and
languages,
and languages and. And they're all saying different stuff. And, you know, I think when I grew up they tried to pretend that they weren't saying different stuff, but they are saying different stuff.
Compare the four Gospels and there's contradictions in all of them. Like, yeah.
Totally. And so to be able to go, there's a mess there, but I'm going to move forward with faith and I'm going to act in faith. I think, I don't know, that feels more dangerous.
Mm.
But I love that. I think that's, and I think in... To sort of swing back around to songwriting, I think, I think I'd love to be able to, I write some songs about faith, but I'd love to be able to do that more to sort of capture, I don't know, it's not that I don't have an agenda. I'm not trying to, you know, convert everybody to progressive theology or, you know, there's no agenda there. It's more that I think writing for me is about me expressing myself authentically so that somebody who's listening who happens to share even in part that experience, that it might bring them out of their isolation just a little bit. And so I think if people aren't talking about faith it sounds a bit judgmental. If they aren't talking about every facet of faith and what faith can look like in the broad spectrum, if it's narrow, and I do feel like it is a bit narrow in Christian music, there's a whole bunch of people there that they're not hearing songs that that express their version of faith. And so I think, to me, that's the beauty of writing, is being able to go, I'm going to write about something that's true for me and authentic for me, and maybe it will be for someone else. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. As someone who does their best to write songs, it's always this
that's,
like...
That's the best we could ever do.
Yeah. Yeah. It, like, for me, I guess, like, I love having conversations about the monetary side of art, because that's a really interesting thing to navigate. But ultimately, all I can hope for is that someone else hears it and it moves them.
Yeah.
Because then job done.
Yeah.
Because you've had the fulfillment of creating the thing.
Yep.
But then that's only 50% of it. The other 50% for me is like when people tell me that they like a song that I wrote really resonated with them, like day made. I'm a happy
totally,
man. Like
totally.
That's the goal.
I made a room of people at a folk club cry not that long ago. And someone said to me afterwards, he said, well, it's not what we usually have. Because it might not be, it was a bit not very diplomatic. It probably isn't quite a fit for here. Oh, but he said, oh, but it really, you know, really, really brought a tear to the eye. But yeah, I don't know whether it's what we usually have here. And I'm like, to me, I'm like, I don't care. I made a room of grown men cry.
I don't know if you get this, but I often, like, with friends of mine who know me, when they compliment a piece of art, whether it's a story or a song, they go, now I'm not just saying this, I do actually mean this. As if we were going to say.
As if they're lying.
We would assume that they're just telling us that because we know them.
Well, it's hard when it's biased, isn't it? But I feel like as an artist, you start to. You can tell the difference between the friends who are actually fans and the ones that
totally
aren't.
Totally. Not to call them out, but.
No. The ones that, you know, are buying out of guilt.
Yeah.
Oh, the joys.
Well, look forward to hearing what that might look like in the future as you pursue that.
Well, I will eventually. I think I need to give my subconscious a rest for a year, and then I'll probably start writing again.
Yeah, well, so that was going to be my question is, what's the next thing for you? Is it just rest? Because I know you've got a three-year-old daughter?
I've got a three-and-a-half-year-old, yeah. I mean, I always rest a bit creatively after writing something. I always note down ideas, but I don't really touch them for a little while. But I think... in terms of musically, I don't know yet. I don't know what the next, you know, exploration will be. We'll see. My main thing, I mean, I haven't said this publicly anyway, so it's
exclusive
out there. But I don't know if it's possible because I'm doing things the underground way, but I would love, maybe with my next release or maybe the one after that, to get a chart position on the ARIA charts. Because, see, I'm putting it out there in the world.
Manifestation,
man. Because the numbers aren't that huge. It's just that at the moment, because I sell privately, I don't know whether I can register the sales. You know, I'll have to look into all of that. But so I feel like the next couple of years will be about trying to build my following to a size where that's maybe doable on the next release. So there's exciting. A little bit of ambition there.
Yeah,
I feel like
it.
I don't know whether I'll quite make it by the next one. It might be the one after that. But I do know of an indie band in the US that did that and got on Billboard. And it happened to be because it was a smaller category and they got the number one spot. And because the ARIA charts are smaller than Billboard, the numbers are not insane.
No.
So that's my little professional take over the world goal.
I'm always shocked when I hear how low the sale numbers are.
They're quite
for the
top low.
Yeah.
You've just got to sell them all at the same time.
In that first week.
Yeah, but you can do that with pre-sales.
Yes.
So, So I feel like I'm not that far off with how Mayfly's going. So I think, okay, if I can just double my audience size, I reckon I'd get a spot.
That's awesome.
So that's my next little goal. Although you could get a bad week. I mean, imagine if you're released when some...
Yeah.
You still get a chart position, but, you know, I'm sure it would vary from week to week what the top spots are.
Yeah. I did actually not accidentally, just my own short-sightedness, released the song last year on the same day as my brother's band, who have a much bigger following. It's like they've been operating for quite a while, and I released a little solo thing, and all our friends and family.
Yeah, they went straight for your brother's thing.
Which is fine because they're a lot better than my little solo pop thing. But still.
Yeah.
You don't want to release the same week as like a new Ed Sheeran record or something.
No, that's right. That's right. Yeah. I did read about someone who had their, they had a sort of failed relationship with a label, and their album was released the same week as Madonna in the late 90s. And I was like, yeah, you're buggered.
Yeah. On the other hand, if by some miracle you're the artist that tops Madonna.
Like, I know. If nothing's happening that week, like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, 800 sales and I'm number one. You know, not in the US. In Australia, that might be possible. But anyway, so that's kind of a little. So some marketing goals. Creatively, I'm always a follow your nose kind of person. So I'll just kind of see, you know, there's my thoughts about faith that I've shared and writing there, and you know, just other collaborations I might want to try out and just see where the muse takes me back to the old muse. And yeah but eventually you know I'll pick myself up off the floor after finishing this release and start creating again and see what happens.
A lot of work for a double album, I can imagine. Like,
it's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah, time for rest.
Nice to just not think about it for a while.
Yeah. Absolutely. So where can people find you?
RachelCollis.com.
Yep.
That's RachelCollis.com.
And that's it. Socials, I know you're on Facebook.
Yes, the page is Rachel Collis Original Music.
Yep.
I've got to get rid of the original music. I don't need that. I put that there years ago. Goes without saying. I mean, I don't really use my Instagram for my music. So you'll find, if you go to my Instagram, you'll find lots of pictures of op shop clothes. So it's not quite so I should do something about that. So it's mainly just Facebook and I'm on YouTube. I have a YouTube channel.
Yep.
Some videos. I am on Spotify. I've got a few songs on there.
Just not the new record. You got to go.
There's one new song, one song from the new record up there, and I'll probably put a second one up in 6 months or something. So.
Yeah, cool.
That might be it.
So go and find Rachel on
everywhere.
The website, ideally. Yeah. It's very easy. I bought it during the week. You go on.
I noticed. I'm like, oh, I know that name.
It's very easy to do. Go and check her out in all those places. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks for listening to me talk.
Yeah, it was great. We'll have to have you back when for the next record.
That's right. When I'm aiming for that chart position.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this longer episode, and we'll see you again on Friday for our conversation with Michael Jensen.